workshop, and our the topics on Lean Frontier in clinical practice. And today we really have a very outstanding speaker, Dr. Richard Simon. He is indeed a frontier in cancer clinical trial, or in clinical trial in general. And Dr. Simon is the chief of biometric research branch and head of molecular statistics and biomarker section in division of cancer treatment and diagnosis in National Cancer Institute. And he has a PhD in applied mathematics and computer science. And he joined the National Institute of Health in 1969, and so it's been a long time. And he has published over 400 papers in biostatistics methodology, publication, and in biomedicine journals. And because he is an outstanding achievement, he is an elected fellow of American Statistical Association. That's a great honor in the international study community. And yesterday afternoon, we all enjoyed his inspiration lecture on targeted clinical trials. And you also heard a very fancy name, genomic classifiers. And today's workshop is a combination along these topics. And we also heard about gene expression. So today, Dr. Simon will introduce the gene expression analysis along with his famous BRB array tools. And yesterday he told us the user has been bound to over 6,000. Maybe on the proceeding you only see there's over 5,000. I think because our lecture, our workshop, so the number has jumped up. And so the user is over 60 countries or over the world. In addition, he's a leading author of a book, Design and Analysis of DNA Microarray. And so, actually, we are very privileged to have this great opportunity to listen to his lectures. And he's very serious for everything. So, last night, he didn't sleep too much. He's still preparing for our lecture. So we should be keep awake. And now let's welcome Dr. Simon.
Thanks very much, and thank you for attending. I'm really delighted to be here. I'd like to thank Dr. Wang Peng for organizing this and the sponsors for sponsoring it. And it's a great privilege for me to be here and a great pleasure, really. And my only real question as I sort of tried to organize my presentation was how much to make it try to make it a hands-on, walk you through how to use BRB array tools, and how much to make it a more conceptual focus on analysis of microarray data. And we actually had a full house signed up, I think over 300 people, and you know, I guess a lot of people didn't show up, but I thought with a large group like that, it could be a problem to try to do it as a hands-on kind of thing. I've done some hands-on things sort of for a shorter period of time, but I guess my feeling was it would be better to put the main focus on sort of conceptual focus on analysis of microarray data, and to sort of try to illustrate some things at various points by sort of showing, you know, what the options are and how to do it in the software BRB array tools. So I'm going to do it sort of as a mixture of the two things, but most of it I think will be sort of a focus on the conceptual aspects of the data analysis, because I think that's something that's really important. And hopefully you can take with you in the future if you need it regardless of sort of what software you're using. And now, so anyway, that's sort of, you know, the other thing is it's always different people, their sort of their learning style that they do best is different from person to person. So some people really, they don't like sort of to be talked at. They really want to have, you know, to be walked through the analysis. And so I'm, you know, I apologize in advance if sort of the way I'm going to try to do it isn't exactly what you would have preferred. But anyway, we'll try to do a mixture of the two. You have, of course, there the website. That's the main website of my biometric research branch, and from that website, it leads to a variety of things, including the BRBRA tool software site, and PowerPoint presentations, sound files of talks I've given, including some that were sort of shorter tutorials on actually the use of BRBRA tools, and reprints and technical reports of papers, mostly reprints, and actually there's a new thing on the BRBRA tools page, and that's a BRBRA tools data archive. We've sort of one of the new features we're going to have in the next release of BRBRA tools is you can sort of automatically import data from this gene expression omnibus database of the National Center for Biotechnology Information, and it automatically imports it as a BRBRA tools project, and then you can, without fiddling with it at all, you can start analyzing other people's data. And we've actually created an archive of over 100 data sets with associated clinical data that have been public domain data sets associated with publications, most of which we got from the Gene Expression Omnibus, but some of which we got from other sources. And so that's also, I guess I can quickly show you that. We go here to the the other thing is I was going to say is you don't need to have your computers on at this point. When we start sort of walking through analyses, I think there'll be plenty of time to turn your computers on. So if you're worried about your battery life or stuff, really for quite a while I'm not going to be doing the hands-on kind of stuff. So we'll get to that later. But if we go to the BRBRA tools, this is the main page of the BRBRA tools website, and we can go to the BRBRA tools page. And one of the things on that page is this BRBRA tools data archive, and we can click on that, and then it lists over 100 of these data sets. And so, and there's a little blurb about the publication that gave rise to that data, and then there's the citation, then there's the BRBRA tools file, project file, which we've already imported into BRBRA tools, including the clinical data, and so it's all ready to sort of start analyzing. So all you have to do is click on that to download it and unzip it and then sort of open the project workbook. And there's also a little README file associated with each of these, so it tells you a little bit about the data set and see if that's a data set that you're interested in or not. Okay. And we also have, this is the book that we alluded to that was published. I was a lead author, but several other members of my branch wrote chapters in the book. It's not about BRBRA tools, although we have one appendix about BRBRA tools in the book, and but it's about analysis of microarray data, and we have actually we did a Google search on citations of publications that cited BRBRA tools as the or one of these software programs that they use for analysis, and so we've included that list there. Also, there's a message board where people sort of post questions that they have and about either BRBRA tools or about the analysis of their data. And we look at that every day and try to post answers. And other users post answers too. And this is sort of for the download page. Okay. So there's a lot of stuff on the on that website. I won't go into some of the other stuff. What was my motivation for developing BRBRA tools? I think it was sort of mostly frustration at seeing other, you know, the available software that much of which seem to induce people to analyze their data improperly, in what I thought wasn't really an appropriate way. And also the whole sort of biotech revolution, putting biomedical scientists at a very difficult situation of wanting to use the new tools like microarrays, and yet now then being confronted with much more analysis sort of issues of how do you make sense, how do you make biological sense out of that kind of data, and then being beset by a literature of mixed messages and hype and lots of people publishing their methods and claiming great things for their methods and not knowing what software to use or what to believe about what's the appropriate way of analyzing data. Just seeing so much misinformation. So after sort of having spent several years collaborating with people on the analysis of their data and developing methods and, you know, critically reading the literature and I decided that sort of the way to try to transmit at least my viewpoint of those issues to and my sort of whatever I had to offer about how properly to analyze data and take advantage of that kind of technology was to try to embed in software sort of my viewpoint, my advice, and to embed it in software in a way that would sort of help biomedical scientists educate themselves about analyzing that kind of data. And so the target audience was really biomedical scientists, but I actually use BRBRA tools for training my own statistical and machine learning postdocs. And because I think a lot of the conventional wisdom about statistical analysis doesn't actually apply to this kind of high dimensional data. And there are a lot of very challenging statistical issues and a lot of opportunities for mistakes if you're sort of learning it from scratch, trying to reinvent things yourself. So I tried to have the software be both an analysis package, not really to sort of just as a to showcase or make available methods that I have developed, but an analysis package that includes the analysis tools that I use and that I feel are the best ones and the most appropriate ones. Some cases are very simple, some cases they're complicated. There's no advantage to complexity when something simple will work. And so really some things that other people have developed, there's SAM in it, there's PAM in it, there's various methods that I think are useful that others have developed and we put it in there. So it's not really just to showcase methods that me or my group have developed, but to present methods that we feel are good methods for certain kinds of microarray problems. and to present it in a way that non-statisticians can use and can, as a result of using, educate themselves about analysis issues for high dimensional data. So those were sort of the objectives. It's sort of an integrated package in the sense of it, you're supposed to import your data into it once, and then there's lots of different analysis tools depending upon your objectives. So you don't keep re-importing your data every time you want to do something different. You import your data once, you import basically all of your data, and then for all of the various kinds of comparisons you might want to do, you just sort of specify it in a program. We'll go through that, how you specify it as to how you, what comparison you want to do. But you don't keep re-importing your data for every new kind of comparison or every new kind of analysis you want to do. We used Excel as sort of the front, as a front end, because lots of people are familiar with Microsoft Excel. Excel is really the only proprietary software you need to use with BRB array tools, and we used a lot of the macro facilities of Excel. It has a macro language called VBA, so we use that to sort of write all of our dialog boxes and things like that. We almost never use any of the analysis features of Excel. The one exception, I think, is the scatter plot. But other than that, we're really just using Excel as sort of a front end in which we call programs that we've written in other languages. Now, we also use the R statistical programming language for a lot of things. A lot of the things in BRB array tools are very computationally intensive, and languages like R or S+ are not really good for very computationally intensive calculations. They are not what's called compiled languages, and so they're just not good for really things that are really intensive. So for many of the analyses that are computationally intensive, we generally program it in either Fortran or C. Most of it is in Fortran. And so we have things in here that are really optimized computationally. For example, our version of SAM, we reprogram SAM in Fortran, so it's about 9 times faster than any version of SAM available in Bioconductor or on the web. So basically we're using Excel, but we're using it sort of as a front end. And we're constantly adding new things to it. There's a lot of focus within BRB array tools on annotations of genes. When you find genes that are significant, or in some kind of an analysis, we put lots of hyperlinks in there to give the information that we've collected about the annotations. We collect that information either from, for example, a manufacturer's website like NetAffix for the Affymetrix platform, or in many cases from the source database at Stanford, which has a lot of annotation information for non-Affymetrix arrays. And we sort of automatically import that stuff to annotate the genes represented on your arrays. BRB array tools is not tied to any database. We tried to make it not tied to any database and not tied to any platforms. And so it should work. It works with Affymetrix platforms. It works with essentially any two-color platform. And we have certain universal importers for importing your data in whatever format the image analysis program associated with that platform or that you've used has created. And we also built in automatic importers for certain commonly used platforms, like for Affymetrix cell files, or for gene picks, which is a commonly used image analysis program. So we've built in automatic importers. We've built in an automatic importer for this MAD-B database used at the National Cancer Institute, and we're building an automatic importer now for Rosetta Resolver data. Basically what happens is three kinds of data that, I think I'll get into that a little bit more later. So it's highly computationally efficient, it's sensitive gene and pathway annotation features. We'll go over these more later. There's also actually for a plug-in facility, so user can actually, if they know something like the R programming language, they can write their own R functions and easily integrate them into BRB array tools. And I've mentioned this data archive. I mentioned the book. Now, I thought what I would do now, since I wasn't really sure whether, how many people in the audience actually might not be familiar at all, even with microarray technology. So I thought I'd run through briefly microarray technology. So basically, what we really would like to know is sort of the concentration of every protein in a cell, even more than that. At least the concentration of every protein in a cell, because proteins really do the work. But there is no really genome-wide or even anything approaching a genome-wide assay for protein concentrations, because proteins have three-dimensional structures and you don't have hybridization that you have for nucleic acids. You don't have that kind of thing that you can use uniformly genome-wide when you're trying to do assays on proteins. So with certain exceptions with proteins, we're still sort of in a one protein at a time assay framework. I mean, there are certain exceptions to that, like there are antibody arrays, but nothing sort of approaching the technology of the microarray for essentially messenger RNA or genomic DNA, where we can really assay things genome-wide in one fell swoop. So I don't think I'll, going to go through the detail. Don't need to review the biology of gene expression. But we're trying to estimate the abundance of each species of messenger RNA molecules for a collection of cells. That's really what the microarray is trying to do. It's not sensitive enough really to analyze single cells, because generally you're using fluorescence as your sort of detection signal. And so you need a lot of cells to assay. And that in itself, of course, creates certain limitations to get sort of, either you wind up with a heterogeneous collection or in some cases, you try to have it more homogeneous. And basically, what you wind up doing then is taking your collection of cells, extracting the messenger RNA from those cells, labeling it with a fluorescent label, and then hybridizing it onto a solid surface that sort of contains a spot of DNA corresponding to each gene. And the spots on the array, the spots of various types, they could either have been printed on the array or they could have been created by photolithography. But the point is that they're in known positions corresponding to which gene they correspond to. Some of these I'm covering pretty quickly. So basically what you have here is, collecting the messenger RNA from a collection of cells, in this case, for a two-color array, not necessarily just a cDNA array. In this case, this is an old slide showing sort of the approach where the spots on the solid, so the solid surface essentially is a coated microscope slide. The spots are printed spots of cDNA printed on this microscope slide. And with this type of platform, what you do is you take your collection of cells, you extract a messenger RNA, you reverse transcribe it, and in that process you either directly or indirectly label the nucleic acid with a fluorescent dye, and you hybridize it onto the surface of the slide and put a cover slip down. And generally with this type of array, or even if you've printed oligonucleotides on the array instead of printed spots of cDNA, then you usually use some reference sample of RNA reverse transcribed and fluorescently labeled with a different dye. The fluoresces at a different wavelength, mix them together, and then put them down on the same microscope slide. And then illuminate that microscope slide with two different frequencies of laser light. One, a frequency that will tend to make the one dye fluoresce. The other, a frequency that tends to make the other dye fluoresce. And then measure the intensity of fluorescence at each location along the slide. And so what you wind up with at each location along the slide are two numbers. An intensity of fluorescent when you illuminate with this frequency, and an intensity of fluorescence when you illuminate with that frequency. And the hope is that those intensities will be proportional. I'm sorry, I guess I missed one point here. Is you hybridize, then you wash off the excess. And so the idea here really is that each labeled nucleic acid will only hybridize to the spot corresponding to the spot corresponding to the same gene. So messenger RNA will seek the spot that is sort of complementary, because it's a spot of cDNA from an oligonucleotide from the same gene. So consequently, when you get, and then you wash off the excess, and so all of that is done so that the intensity of fluorescence over a given spot will hopefully be proportional in some way to the concentration of messenger RNA in either the experimental sample or the reference sample, in this case in the experimental sample, in this case in the reference sample, the concentration of messenger RNA that resulted from transcription of the gene represented by that spot. Now, of course, there's lots of experimental sources of variability, so there's no direct readout of concentration, just an intensity that you hope is proportional to that concentration. Now, and so this is now the one other point, and I guess we'll go through it in a little bit more detail, is when we talk about measuring intensities at every point on this slide, the way these when you have a measurement of intensities along a solid surface, those measurers, using photomultiplier tubes, don't know where these spots are. So they're sort of measured at every little pixel location along the slide. And the first step in analyzing the data is going to be sort of segmenting all of those little pixel intensities in each of the two color channels into what's the total fluorescence associated with each spot. So that's sort of the image analysis stage. And we're not going to go through that. That's BRBRA tools doesn't do that. And so it sort of takes the data that comes out from whatever image analysis software is associated with your platform or that you're using. So this is just one example of kind of file that comes out of an image analysis program, and it has things like usually they're more complicated than this, but it has things for each fluorescent channel, for each of those two fluorescent frequencies, things like how much fluorescence in that channel it found, what the mean pixel intensity was, what the median pixel intensity was, what the standard deviation of the pixel intensity was, and things like that. And so, as I mentioned, with these two color arrays, the spots are either cDNA or oligos printed on the slide, usually. And here's sort of a slide trying to show why these printed arrays are generally use two colors. Use sort of a control sample of RNA and a sample that you're interested in. This data sort of came from one slide that had, I think several hundred spots on it. And each of these spots, I think these were cDNAs that were identical. They were printed, the same cDNA was printed a couple of hundred times on one microscope slide. And what was hybridized to that one slide was extractions of messenger RNA from, I think, two sources, fibroblasts and C2C12 cells. And in one source was labeled with one fluorescent dye, the other messenger RNA sample was labeled with the other dye. They were mixed together. They were hybridized on one slide. And what this shows, so each dot here corresponds to a fluorescence intensity in the Psi-3 for the Psi-3 dye and a fluorescence intensity for the Psi-5 dye at a particular spot on that one array. And so what you see is even though these spots were supposed to be identical, the intensities sort of are all over the map. So the spots are identical. You're measuring intensity of exactly the same messenger RNA, labeled messenger RNA source on one slide, and you're getting intensities all over the map. And there's sort of two reasons for that. One reason is when these robots print these spots on slides, they don't give homogeneous size spots. Now, maybe some of the commercial, more recent commercial arrays probably give more homogeneous size spots compared to what this was when this was done. This was a homebrew, I think. But nevertheless, that's one big source of variability. And the other big source of variability is when you, after labeling your messenger RNA in from one source and your messenger RNA from your reference source, and then mixing them together, and what do? You sort of splash it down on the slide, cover it with a cover slip, let it sit there for whatever, 12 hours or whatever it is, and then wash off the excess. So that's a pretty low-tech procedure, and you don't set you don't have uniform distribution of that mixed sample across the face of the slide, and so that's also a big source of variation in concentration. And so, but the one thing that is pretty constant is that those sources of variability are happening for both of these samples together. So it's an effect of the spots, and it's an effect of the distribution of the mixed sample across the face of the slide. And those things affect both samples equally. And so the ratio of intensity of, say, the red channel to the green channel is sort of constant. That's why we get this sort of straight line relationship. And, so, and that's basically the reason for using a reference sample with printed arrays. It's not really because usually you want to compare anything to your reference. The reference is just providing you a way of measuring expression of your sample of interest in a relative manner that permits you to compare expression in that sample to expression in lots of other samples, or to use it in that way while getting rid of a lot of sources. Since you're using this relative measure, you're getting rid of lots of sources of variability that otherwise you would have. Now, with Affymetrix gene chips, the spots are created by photolithography, and so they have much less variation in size. And the sample, labeled sample, is actually circulated on the inside of the gene chip. And so you don't have those sources of variability. And so they use single label. It's a sort of a single label platform. You don't use a reference RNA. The one thing about the gene chip is that one of the limitations of the photolithography process is, I believe, the expense goes up fairly dramatically, and the error rate goes up dramatically if you use very long try to have very long oligonucleotides. So they use short oligos, and short oligos don't have the sensitivity, they don't have the specificity for targeting, for hybridizing only to a single to messenger RNA from a single gene. And so in order to get around that, they use multiple short oligos to correspond to each gene. So you have each spot is what's called a probe, and they have sort of perfect match and mismatch probes, and then sort of for each of these probe pairs, there's 10 to 15 of them that form a part of a probe set, and that probe set corresponds to a single gene. I'm not going to spend too much time on the details of how you the algorithms that are available. We'll talk about it a little bit for translating from these probes and probe pairs to probe sets and to get expression measurements that relate to genes rather than to individual probes. Skip some of these slides that are sort of details about the Affymetrix technology. Some of those protocols have actually changed anyway. So basically you have some experimental design driving some microarray experiment, and you do your hybridizations. There's some image analysis, and you wind up with some digital files coming out of the image analysis, and there's some initial sort of, well, you could call pre-processing steps that don't have anything really to do with the particular objectives of your experiment, but they're sort of just to sort of help equalize, to help get rid of some of the variations among the maybe intensities for different arrays and get rid of some of the sources of variability. And that's usually called sort of the normalization step. And following that, then, you have a set of data that you want to really analyze to answer the questions that you're posing. And those analyses then should be driven very much by your biological questions. I think I'm going to really skip through the image analysis stuff. I don't have much stuff on it anyway here. I guess just those two slides. So why do we need normalization for dual channel microarray data? The process of normalization for dual label platform data is really quite different than the process of normalization for affymetric single label data. Really, for dual label data, what normalization is trying to do is account for sort of inherent differences in these two fluorescent dyes, and differences in their propensity for DNA, differences in the sensitivity of detection of fluorescence in those two different frequencies, and potentially even differences in the concentrations of the dyes you've used. So it's trying to balance the red versus the green on each array individually. And affymetrix arrays are really, nothing's balanced individually. The objective of normalization of them is to sort of balance intensity level across your entire set of arrays that you've included in your experiment. Your entire set of arrays, they may have been assayed different days, there may have been changes in some of the details of the arraying, and so there may be just various differences in the basic intensity levels of these different arrays, and they need to be sort of normalized relative to each other. Ideally, what you'd like to have for purposes of normalization is some genes that you could think of as housekeeping genes that are expressed equally in all specimens, in both your reference and your experimental specimens on a given array, so that you could know that any intensity differences you see are just due to the technology and need to be corrected and don't really reflect intensity difference, real differences in concentration, or intensity, or when you're normalizing in the affymetrix arrays across the whole set of arrays, that you would know that for those genes, the basic concentration of those genes should be same across the whole set. And for example, with affymetrix for humans, I think the company has done some experiments and identified what they think are housekeeping genes, but I think it's questionable whether there are any real housekeeping genes, and so that are always expressed at a fixed level. And so sometimes most of the normalization procedures that are used sort of use all of the genes on the array, represented on the array, rather than a defined set of housekeeping genes, and with the assumption being made that the set of genes that are sort of really differentially expressed will form a small percentage of the full set of maybe 30,000 genes. And so if you use normalization procedures based on things like medians that are robust to differences in small proportions of the genes, then the idea is you should be able to do normalization in that way. Those kinds of normalization procedures run into a problem if you're talking about custom arrays, where the arrays contain relatively small number of genes that have been selected because you think they're going to be differentially expressed in the context of the samples that you're going to see. So whenever you develop custom arrays, you should not just include the genes that you think are informative for the different states that you're trying to detect, but also some genes that you can use for normalization purposes. Otherwise, you'll have a problem with normalization. The the simplest sort of normalization is to say, well, for a two-color array, is to say, well, the red intensities are some multiple of the green intensities, and that multiple is sort of determined by some imbalance from all of these various sources that I mentioned, and we'll estimate what that multiple is by, say, taking the median of the red versus green ratio, where we might have a red versus green ratio. Subscript I is for the ith spot on the array, and we can take the median of those ratios, or almost equivalently we'll just leave it at that, and use that as a basis for sort of normalization. And there's lots of variants of that simple idea, but it's basically assuming that one intensity is sort of a multiple of the other, and then using something robust like a median that should be robust to a small, relatively small proportion of genes that actually really are differentially expressed in, by various amounts, and so that are not the red versus green, and those genes are not just related by that same multiple. So if you use things like a median, the idea is that they should be robust to the relatively small proportion of truly differentially expressed genes. And then basically to plot your data, and there's a couple of ways you can plot your data to see that that really once you do that kind of normalization by estimating that normalization factor, then things sort of pretty much line up for the mass of genes. Again, this is a plot where it's the log of green on the x-axis and the log of red on the y-axis, and for a given array, and each dot represents a spot on the array. This is what's called an MA plot, which is often used as sort of a diagnostic of whether that simple kind of relationship of the red being a multiple of the green holds. In the MA plot, on the y-axis, you have the log, usually to the base 2, of the red to green ratio. And on the x-axis, you have A, the average, which is sort of the log of, it's written there as the log 2 of red times green, but the log of red times green equals the log of red plus the log of green. So it's really the average of the logs of the red and the green channel. And so if that simple red is k times green held, then when you looked at this MA plot, things should be sort of more symmetrical. There should be some line, and you should sort of see things above the line and below the line equally, maybe with some outliers that represented the differentially expressed genes. You shouldn't see this funny shape like that. And so what the funny shape represents is that it looks like that the normalization, that the degree of red to green bias is intensity dependent, that the red to green bias at low intensities is different than the red to green bias at high intensities, and it should maybe be using separate normalization factors for different ranges of intensities. And so that has led to Terry Speed and his group basically developing these low-S smoothers as a basis for doing the normalization, fitting sort of a nonlinear function through the MA plotted data and estimating sort of a how the normalization factor should vary with the average intensity of the red and green channel of the spot. And these are sort of showing these fitted smoothers, and they even gone beyond that and saying, well, you know, it looks like, they claim that it looks like in some of their data that the normalization, the red to green bias also varies by the print tip of the robotic printer that printed the spots. And so, and if you look at these two-color arrays, what you see are different grids of spots, and each grid is printed by a different finger on the robotic printer. And so there are these, in addition to the low-S smoothing intensity-based normalization, there are these, you can do low-S smoothing with separate by print tip. And this sort of shows what the data looks after the normalization. Now for affymetrix arrays, as we mentioned, a need for normalization not between the two channels on single arrays, but rather across the whole set of arrays, just because the basic intensity can vary. And we talked about housekeeping genes. And there, again, also the simplest method that's used there is basically just to scale each array to multiply it by a constant so that the median intensity on each array equals some target value. And basically pretty much similar to the kind of idea that's used for the simple normalization in the two-color arrays. And there are also then intensity-dependent normalizations where you sort of pick one array as sort of the basis, since you don't, and then do MA plots of all of the other arrays versus that, and then do low-S smoothing of those MA plots to get intensity-dependent normalization for sort of each array. Okay. Another sort of part of the pre-processing is with the two-color arrays at least, is sort of saying, well, you know, in some case, if you're going to analyze data based on ratios, then there's a potential problem when you're talking about spots in which the intensity is very low, because for those, the ratio is going to be very unstable. And so often what's done is if the signal is low in both channels at a spot, then it's just considered missing, because you don't want to calculate a ratio for such a spot, because it'll be sort of just too variable, too unstable. But if it's low in one channel and above a threshold in another channel, then sometimes what you do is you bring it up to this minimal threshold in the channel in which it's low, don't touch it in the channel in which it's above that threshold, and calculate your ratio that way. And that's very commonly used sort of spot filtering strategy. In that case, it's not really filtering, but it's sort of modifying the intensities before ratios are calculated. And there's also, well, part of this pre-processing is sort of gene filtering. In some cases, the image analysis program will tell you that it basically couldn't detect any good, nicely shaped spot at a place where it should correspond to a given place on the array, and so it'll flag it as sort of a undetected value. And so sometimes if a gene has too many undetected flags across all of the arrays you've used in your experiment, then you might say, okay, I really don't want to analyze that gene. There's just too much bad data or low-intensity data for it. And the other thing is, you may have done a genome-wide thing, so you may have data on 30,000 or more genes, but for the purpose of your experiment, most of those genes may not show any, you know, very much variation at all across all of your arrays. And so, sort of in the interest of sort of simplifying the analyses and sometimes speeding them up, what you do is you say, well, let's just get rid of the gene, let's exclude from the analysis the genes that don't show a certain amount of variation across the full set of arrays. And when you say the full set of arrays, it means we're not sort of talking about what kind of comparisons we're making. We're just saying, do things like, well, for this gene, what's the median expression if I look at all of my arrays? And then what proportion of the arrays show an expression at least 1.5-fold different from that median, either greater or below? And if that proportion of arrays that are, say, maybe at least 1.5-fold different than the median is less than some specified percentage, then I'll just exclude that gene. And these kind of rules are basically arbitrary. And you don't have to do any of this gene filtering at all, really. It's really just for sort of speeding things up and really just for that purpose. I think I, unless there's some particular interest in it, I don't really want to get into the, there are a lot of algorithms for affymetrics array data for how do you go from these probes and probe pairs, and how do you use the data for all of the probes that correspond to a given gene, how do you summarize that data to give an intensity for that gene? And there have been over time a variety of summary measures. For example, a very old one was, well, for gene I, take an average for all of the probes associated with gene I. Take the intensity, this is after normalization, of the jth perfect match probe minus its associated mismatch probe. And for that difference, average those differences over all of the probes that are supposed to be reflecting expression of gene I. And that will be an average difference. That will be a measure of an expression that we will take for gene I on that particular array. And there was also, with that algorithm that Affymetrix had included in their software, it excluded probe pairs that are more than 3 standard deviations from the average. And things have then gone on to become more and more sophisticated and from there, there was a Affymetrix Mass 5 algorithm that used these sort of non-parametric biweights rather than just an arithmetic mean with the outliers excluded. And then academic groups have gotten into looking, once Affymetrix sort of started to make the data available, more which probes corresponded to the same gene and even what the sequences of those probes were. People have started to look at the detailed data and find that some of these probes look like they're working and some of them don't look like they're working. This is sort of for a given gene, the probe pairs for a given gene on, I guess this is on one array, and each well, as we go along the x-axis, we're looking at the different probes that correspond to that same gene, and in some cases the probes are showing very little difference, in some cases they're showing
a lot of difference. I guess these were for maybe two samples. I'm not sure. But anyway, as you sort of get into detail of analyzing the detailed probe level data, as some of the academic groups have done, they find that some of these probes just don't really seem to be working. And in retrospect, we found that a lot of these probes were designed based on early sequencing of the genes, and so they actually don't actually correspond to the right gene, and so some more sophisticated algorithms have been developed to try to essentially weight different probes of a probe set to calculate the summaries in a way that upweights the good probes and downweights the bad probes. And for the most part, they don't decide what the good probes are or the bad probes are based on any sequence analysis, but rather just sort of how they seem to be, do they seem to be detecting differences and showing differences in some cases and not showing differences in other cases, or are they just sort of showing nothing all along? So the methods themselves are not really biologically based. They're sort of statistical methods. And I myself don't think these will be the final methods. I think finally we'll wind up with methods that are more sort of biologically and sequence based. But there are proponents to these methods and others who would rather just use sort of the methods that are included in the Affymetrix release software. Although the Affymetrix software that does the image analysis and calculates the probe set summaries has gotten more sophisticated too, and in some cases looking like some of these methods. Two of the most popular methods are the methods of Li and Wang included in their DCHIP software, and a method called RMA for robust microarray analysis developed by Rafael Irizarry and included in a bioconductor. We actually, in BRB Array Tools, when we import cell files, we use the RMA method. And we actually have been using the bioconductor function, R function that does RMA, although I think we're going to be doing some changes in that because there are for some purposes, RMA may not be something you want to use. For example, if you normalize your data in this way with either the Li Wang method or this method, and calculate your probe set summaries for your set of arrays in this way, and then you want to develop a classifier, and at some time in the future, classify specimens based on maybe whether a patient is likely or not likely to respond to a therapy or to try to diagnostically classify specimens, you somehow now have to normalize that new array, and if you just blindly sort of apply, you know, either the DCHIP or the RMA, you will have a different normalization for this new array than you do for the set of arrays that you use for developing your classifier. So some people don't like using these kind of methods for that reason, when people are involved in clinical prediction, using predictive classifiers clinically. Also, Affymetrix provides a sort of present-absent call sort of for each gene, for example, BRB Array Tools permits you to sort of sort of eliminate genes from analysis if there aren't enough present calls. But I think, for the most part, we recommend ignoring those presence absent calls.
That's the sort of the introduction to the technology. Now I was going to go to a section on design, and but are there any questions or comments or at this point? Anybody have anything they want to say or ask? Okay. I think there's a at least originally there was a myth, mostly by people who weren't really trying to do microarray experiments, and the myth was that the microarray was like just looking under a microscope, and really it was just unstructured data mining looking for answers to questions that you never even thought of asking. And I think most people have found that that doesn't work very well in terms of effective use of the technology. That well, that you have to have some idea of what your objectives are. Go back to that for a moment. In terms of using this technology effectively, you no longer need gene-specific mechanistic hypotheses that you're trying to test, but you have to know more. Are you trying to find genes that are differentially expressed under when you block the blood supply to the kidney, or are you trying to develop a classifier that can be used to distinguish responders from non-responders, and to select your samples properly and to select your analyses properly? And I think there's also a lot of misconception, perhaps still is, particularly by decision makers who are not really doing microarray experiments, that the big challenge was managing the data, that microarray technology is generating a whole lot of data, and we need software technology and computer scientists to help manage this data. And I think that's really a myth. Actually, the amount of data involved, it may be a lot of data to, what compared to what biologists are used to in single gene or single protein assays, but really in absolute terms, the amount of data is not more than, really for any project, is not more than you can handle on any desktop computer. It's really how do you use this technology to get biological answers? How do you design your experiments? How do you analyze your experiments to try to use it to learn something biologically? And as I've said, there's so much hype and misinformation that it's made it particularly difficult for everybody involved. And there's a lot of software, like I say, that was not good and actually encouraged the wrong kind of analyses. And the other, I guess, big challenge was sort of organizing and facilitating effective interdisciplinary collaboration among statisticians, clinicians, and biologists. And my own view is that really to have effective interdisciplinary collaboration, it can't really be effective unless each side sort of increases their knowledge about the issues that, unless statisticians learn a whole lot about the biology and invest their time in doing that, unless the biologists and clinicians invest a lot of time learning about the statistical methods, then I think the interdisciplinary collaboration doesn't really work very well. If you look back at sort of clinical trials as a model, I think there's pretty good interdisciplinary collaboration in that arena between statisticians and clinicians, but really there's been a whole generation of physicians who have been educated to in statistics and in working with statisticians, and really a generation of statisticians who've been educated about clinical trials. And so, and each side has really then invested their time in learning a lot of information that wasn't taught in the discipline they were brought up in. And so I think that same thing has to happen when we talk about new biotechnology, genome-wide assays, and really BRB array tools is sort of one attempt to try to do something innovative in terms of facilitating that process. As I mentioned, overemphasis on the data mining paradigm, and that microarray investigations don't require clear hypotheses or clear objectives. As I've said, they do require clear objectives, but not gene-specific mechanistic hypotheses. And actually, I then tried to, a lot of the objectives can be, I mean, they could be categorized probably in various ways. I think Todd Golub early on introduced class comparison versus class discovery as sort of a categorization of that fit a lot, that a lot of studies fit into. And I like to sort of expand what he called class comparison into class comparison and distinguish it from class prediction, and then have a third group being maybe class discovery. Class comparison, I think of as gene finding. We want to know what genes are differentially expressed between this kind of tumor and normal cells. So we want to find what genes are differentially expressed between high-grade and low-grade tumors of a given type, or between something like that, or what genes are differentially expressed, as I gave the example before, what genes are induced when we cut off the blood supply to the kidney in a mouse. What genes, those kinds of examples. And then class prediction, where the emphasis is not on what genes, the emphasis is on developing some, let's call it a function, that we can sort of put into it an expression profile, and a set of expression levels for measured on a given sample, and it'll give us out some kind of prediction. Now, for example, we might have a bunch of samples collected from patients who got a particular treatment, and some of whom responded to the treatment, some of whom didn't respond to the treatment. And we want to develop a predictor of, based on expression levels of genes, of whether a patient in the future is going to respond or not respond to that treatment. And so in developing a class predictor, we're probably going to want to select which genes help us predict. And the predictor will probably be based on a subset, maybe a very small subset of all the genes. But the name of the game, the purpose, the objective is not what are the genes. The name of the game is what's the predictor, what kind of a predictor. And it's important to make that distinction, because the way you do gene selection in a class comparison sort of study,
the considerations of how do you are things like how do I control multiple, the fact that I'm making multiple comparisons, that I'm making comparisons about for each gene, and how do I wind up doing this in a way that is not to have too many false positive conclusions. With a class and you wind up with various kinds of statistical methods of controlling that multiple comparison issue. With class prediction, there really is no multiple comparison issue, because you're not making really trying to make any conclusions about genes. What you're trying to do is develop something which is a predictor. And so your issues of how stringent or non-stringent I should be in the gene component, the gene selection component of developing that predictor, are driven by to what extent does stringency or non-stringency improve or degrade prediction ability, not to what extent does it, how do I control the number of false positives. So the considerations are actually completely different. So we need to distinguish class prediction from class comparison. And then thirdly, class discovery. These are problems where there's no classes. And sometimes prediction, there's no classes either. We may be trying to predict survival risk, long-term, short-term, but do it in a way that we don't have to categorize survival into long versus short. And I still think of that as sort of class prediction. With class discovery, there's nothing other than expression. And we're trying to say, well, do these expression profiles for these samples, do they all look the same? Plus or minus random variation, experimental variation? Or do they tend to fall into two groups? And sort of it's for situations where you don't really have anything you're trying to correlate it with. Like I was once involved in a study with Jeff Trent's group, Mike Bittner, and associated people of melanoma samples. And we weren't really trying to correlate expression profile with anything about the melanomas. All of these patients had done badly. And these were from patients with advanced melanoma. And really the issue was, are these expression profiles, are they basically all similar, or can we detect multiple subsets of melanoma based on these expression profiles? So it's trying to discover new classes. And class discovery is a difficult sort of thing, because there's nothing really there's no really good way to validate it. You could say, well, you could validate it by seeing whether the classes you discover are associated with good survival versus bad survival, or high grade versus low grade. And you can do that, but for some problems like that, you might have been better off just doing it as a class comparison using grade or survival. And similarly, class discovery, in some cases where you're, particularly when people are talking about things like yeast, where really what you're trying to do is cluster the genes and try to discover genes that are in pathways and you know something about those pathways. You know some of the genes that are in the pathways, but by looking for genes whose expression is correlated with other genes and then looking at the pathways that these other genes are in, trying to discover new, to extend your knowledge of what genes are in those pathways. So I think I can fly through the next few slides, because these are class comparison and class prediction and class discovery examples. And so some of the issues of design are sample and control, selection of your samples, issues about replication. If you're using two color arrays, whether cDNA or spotted oligos, there's this issue where you're going to use some reference RNA that you're going to put down on every array, or you're going to try to be fancier and sort of use the opportunity to have two samples per array
use that to try to increase the efficiency of your experiment and not use a reference sample. We'll touch on that. And then how many biological samples. And we talk about sources of variability. Of course, there's lots of sources of variability. The two that I'm gonna try to distinguish here, technical replicates from biological replicates. Technical replicates is fairly straightforward. If we have an RNA, a messenger RNA extracted from a set of cells, and we do multiple arrays from that single set of messenger RNA, say multiply labeled and put down on different arrays, those are technical replicates in that it's just different arrays of the same RNA sample. Sort of everything else is sort of I'm calling a biological replicate. Sometimes calling it a biological replicate doesn't seem quite right. For example, if you're talking about human tissue, humans, and you have different tumors, and a tumor from this patient, a tumor from that patient, if you take a tumor from a patient and do multiple arrays on it, those are technical replicates, but the tumors from the different patients are biological replicates. In a tissue culture experiment, regrowing the cells under whatever your conditions of your experiment are, and then sampling the RNA, in other words, you may, regrowing the cells at a certain time, extracting the RNA from the cells, you then regrow it, extract the RNA. Those are biological replicates. You're not just reassaying, rearraying the same set of RNA. I think there's been a lot of some misinformation, some of it produced by statisticians, based on the failure to distinguish technical replicates from biological replicates. Technical replicates have their role, certainly for early experiments where you're just trying to see if anything is going on, and also protection against bad hybridization. So if you have two arrays for each sample, then if one of them is bad, you can use the one that's good. Really for things like gene finding and prediction, it's much more efficient to have biological replicates. In other words, biological replicates provide a whole lot more information than the technical replicates do. For comparing classes, replication of samples should generally be at the biological level, because we want to make inferences to the population of patients or the population of, in other words, if we have one. You know, if we have one experiment, we grow, we grow cells, and we extract the RNA, and then we treat, and then we grow and treat, and then extract the RNA. And from each of those RNA extractions, we do 10 arrays. We've got 10 versus 10, but we don't really know. Usually the technical variation is small compared to the biological variation. So we don't know whether the differences we're seeing have to do with the treatment or just something funny about the time we sampled the cells. Maybe in one case it was much closer to the cell crowding setting in than in the other case. And that effect could potentially have been more important than the effect of treatment. So if we haven't really repeated the experiment biologically, we've got a problem in terms of what really is our conclusion. And so the other thing is which genes are differentially expressed in two conditions or two tissues. This is really not a clustering problem. Some people, they think of all microarray analysis as cluster analysis. And actually, in my experience, it may just be the problems that I deal with, but almost none of them are clustering problems. They're mostly either class comparison or gene finding of one type or another, in which we're trying to correlate gene expression with something or a prediction problem, but not usually just a clustering class discovery type of thing. So I think the reason people use clustering is, you know, much of the early analyses that came out of Pat Brown's lab were analyzed. These were yeast experiments, and they were analyzed using cluster analysis. Cluster analysis was useful, and it was also the only tool that they had. And there was no statistical analysis of that data at that time. But unfortunately, because of the impact of those papers from that time on, and those programs became available, Mike Eisen's cluster and TreeView programs, and so they've been overused and misused for the wrong problems. So these need supervised methods. The supervised means that there's something other than the expression data itself which is relevant to the analysis, and the analysis needs to be somehow supervised or driven by the other phenotype or the class definition or the survival that that we're trying to sort of relate gene expression to. And it also requires multiple biological samples from each class, as I've said. And originally, I think some people thought, well, all you really need to do is do a single array and have this display in which you sort of color code, take the red intensity and green intensity at a given spot and sort of superimpose those two things and get a nice view of the of the red versus green ratios on that slide. And actually the Affymetrix mass software, I don't know if it's any different now, but it always would, the only analysis it would do would be to compare two arrays. So it just, not two groups, not tumor arrays versus normal arrays, but just this array versus that array. That's all it would do. And so it actually explicitly encouraged people to use terrible methods for analyzing their data. And that sort of goes back to the misconception that really the nature of the problem was managing the data. And so it led decision makers to say, well, all we need are software engineers or computer scientists. We don't actually need statisticians who know anything about analyzing data. And so most of the commercial software was not based on any sort of good data analysis. So that's why it's important that each field get more information about what the nature of things that they don't know about are. So I say comparing expression in two RNA samples just tells you about those samples. It doesn't tell you something about classes that those samples might be from. I will just introduce briefly this concept of reference design, balanced block design, and loop design, but not go into them in detail. We have some papers that go into them in great detail. The reference design, in a very simple situation, is where you have some kind of, these issues only come up when you're using a two-color platform. And so with the reference design, you have some kind of a source of reference RNA, maybe a big source of reference RNA, and you use that on each of your arrays, and it doesn't necessarily and usually won't represent anything that you're interested in. It's only for giving you a relative measure of expression for the samples that you do care about. Now, suppose what you do care about are, say, high-grade tumors and low-grade tumors. And A means high-grade tumors, and B are low-grade tumors. And just to keep it simple here, I've assumed you have two high-grade tumors and two low-grade tumors, and you want to sort of find the genes that are, have a different expression level on average in the high-grade tumors compared to the low-grade tumors. And so this would be a reference design for that. You use the same label on the for the reference sample on all of your arrays, and you have your experimental samples labeled with I guess it's Psi 3 here, and so this is the reference design. And basically, I won't go into how you pick the reference. There are sort of standard references that are commercially available, and other laboratories use sort of mixtures of cell lines of the same species that your experimental sample is from. Basically, you want your reference to sort of represent expression of most of the genes, but not expression at such a high level that you can't see higher expression than that. Now, here's a different design, which we've called a balanced block design. Kevin Dobbin and I sort of introduced. And now there's no reference here at all. We just have each array corresponds to a competitive hybridization between one high-grade RNA from one high-grade tumor and one low-grade tumor. And for example, we might just match the tumors arbitrarily and do it this way. And now we're, in the analysis, we're not, the analysis is not really going to be comparing tumor A1 to tumor B1. It's going to sort of make that comparison for each gene, but then it's going to average it across all of the arrays. And so it's still, it's a class comparison rather than just comparing pairs of arrays. But it's done in such a way that we wind up with averaging direct comparisons of A and B. The other thing, there's a couple of other things to note, whereas when we were talking about the reference design, we've only got two A's and two B's. If we were only going to do four arrays, that's all we could have. With the balanced block design, we've got actually four A's and four B's, and we're still only doing four arrays. And that's because the fact that we're not using the reference gives us more slots for the arrays we really care about. In some cases, that's an advantage. In some cases, it's not. You're limited by the experimental samples, but it still would correspond to you would, if you fix the number of experimental samples of each type available, you'd be able, with a balanced block design, you'd be able to do it with fewer arrays. And the other thing you'll notice is that whereas with the reference design, all of the A's are red and the B's are also, say, red. Here, we've sort of alternated. Two of the A's are labeled with Psi 3 and two of them are labeled with Psi 5, and similarly for the low-grade tumors. And so you can sort of see that in a way the balanced block design, assuming that we had some reasonable way to analyze this, seems like it could be more efficient in terms of our use of arrays at least. And the other thing to notice is that the balanced block design looks like it's good if you want to compare to a high-grade tumor to low-grade tumor. But if you have a bunch of stuff you want to do, then it might not be so good because we've we've embedded our analysis objective, we've meshed it with our hybridization design. And if we have multiple analysis objectives, then there might be a problem. If we go back to the reference design, we haven't said much about what our analysis objective is here, except that, well, it has to do with comparing A's to B's. But if we've done the things this way, we could think of A as high grade and B as low grade, or we could think of, in that same analysis, we could compare tumors that had invaded to a certain level, to, you know, the metastatic, to the non-metastatic, to whatever kind of phenotypes we have. We haven't utilized our classes in an intrinsic way in the way we've done the hybridization, where we have here. And that makes the balanced block design sort of more limited to when you really just have one comparison of interest. The other thing is, if we're going to do a prediction, to try to develop a predictor, the balanced block design looks like it's going to be harder to use because, you know, now in the future we're not going to have an A and a B, we're going to have one sample, and we're going to want to, it seems like it's going to be more complicated here to potentially develop a predictive classifier. And similarly with the balanced block design, it's more complicated to develop, to do clustering if we actually did want to. Of course, if clustering were the main thing, then we wouldn't have A's and B's at all, and there would be no balanced block design. There's also a thing called a loop design, and with a loop design really is more oriented to the situation where we have more than two classes. But here I've shown it with just two classes. And with a loop design, again, you don't use a common reference, but you sort of, for each of the, say, high-grade tumors, each tumor is represented twice in this experiment. So, for example, this array 1, we have a high-grade tumor, A1, hybridized against a low-grade tumor, B1. And on array 2, we have another aliquot of that tumor B1 labeled and with the opposite label that we used for it on array 1 and hybridized against a second high-grade tumor. And then on array 3, we use a new aliquot of that second high-grade tumor, et cetera. And so with more than two arrays, more than two classes, it has the potential of sort of extending some of the advantages of the balanced block design in terms of efficiency, but certainly in a complicated way that's going to require more complicated kind of analysis. Have here citing three papers, Kevin Dobbin and I and Joanne Shee in one of them, in which we go into ultimate detail about the relative merits of these kind of designs. The one paper was the third one there is published in the Journal of National Cancer Institute, and it was written to sort of take the statistical details out of the bioinformatics papers and to present really just the information in a question and answer format about design issues, and there's also sample size issues, number of cases needed for comparisons when using two-color dual-label arrays. So if you do want to read more about the design, I guess I would suggest probably that third paper. There are a lot of myths. There's a myth that common reference designs are inferior to loop designs, and I think really that's in general not true. There are certain situations where loop designs might be useful, but mostly certainly not when you're talking about human tissue. They tend to be mostly in either tissue culture or mouse kind of experiments. So common reference designs are really very effective for many microarray studies. They're robust, they permit lots of comparisons on among the separate tissues, the separate groups, classes, unplanned types of comparisons to be performed because they're not linked to a specific comparison. A hybridization design isn't linked to a specific comparison. And they do permit cluster analyses as sort of a to do in addition to the other kinds of things, and certainly class prediction. And I think the common reference design is probably the most broadly useful design, certainly for human experiments. Loop designs are not robust. If one array is bad, the loop is broken, so you have to do more complicated loop designs with multiple loops. And they're inefficient for sort of cluster analysis, and not really very easily applicable to class prediction analysis. And for simple two-class comparison problems, the balanced block designs are hard to beat. They're really very efficient and require many fewer arrays than reference designs. But they're not really very good for class discovery or class prediction, and they're more difficult to apply to more complicated class comparison problems when there's more than two classes. There's a myth for two-color arrays. Each sample of interest should be labeled once with Psi-3 and once with Psi-5 and dye-swap pairs of arrays. So some people feel very strongly that you should always do dye-swaps of every array. That is, in other words, if you have done an A1 versus B1, you also need to do a B1 versus A1. And if you've done an A2 versus B2, you also need to take another aliquot of those same tumor 2, high-grade tumor 2 and low-grade tumor 2, and do the opposite labeling and do a new array with that. This is very different than what I was calling the balanced block design. See, the balanced block design, if we run back real quickly, A1 is only there once. So each one of these tumors is only there once. There's no technical replicates. Each tumor isn't hybridized on two different arrays. This thing called the dye swap design, each tumor is there twice, once labeled one way and once labeled the other way. The dye swap design is, my feeling is a very inefficient design. And the idea of the dye bias is that there may be certain, but there are the average differences among dyes, differences in the ease with which it gets incorporated into DNA and the sensitivity of detection. These things should be corrected by the normalization process. But there can be gene-specific dye biases in which the degree of dye bias differs from depending on the sequence involved, which may not be corrected by normalization. And gene-specific dye bias, the motivation for this dye swap design is to control for this gene-specific dye bias. And we've done some studies where we actually had dye swap data, and we found that gene-specific dye bias is actually not rare, but it is usually small, but it is a reality. And this is the distribution of the size that we found for gene-specific dye bias, and that where a 1 corresponds to a 2-fold difference. the thing is, even with the gene-specific dye bias, you still don't need the dye swap design. If you use a common reference design, dye swap arrays really are not necessary for valid comparison, because specimens labeled with different dyes are never compared. I don't have another picture of the common reference design, but the common reference design, remember all of the, both the A's and B's were labeled, say, with Psi 5, and Psi 3 was just for the references. So we're never really comparing the experimental samples to the references. We're comparing the A's to the B's. And so we're just using the reference as sort of to give us a relative measure. And so the common reference design is not really subject to any sort of bias from dye bias, because whatever dye bias is there equally for the A's, the low-grade tumors and the high-grade tumors. We actually did an analysis to see to what extent gene-specific dye bias varies among samples, and we found, among classes, we found that that was very rare. So for a two-label direct comparison designs for comparing two classes, it's more efficient to sort of do a balanced block design, in which you just sort of balance the dye to class assignments, but yet only have one tumor represented only once, than it is to have these technical dye swap replicates. So this is the balanced block design again. And as you'll notice, A1 is only there once. So for purposes of gene finding, you're much better off with this than to use up half of your slots with these dye swap. And balancing the dye assignments, having half of the high-grade tumors labeled red and the other half labeled green, itself controls the dye bias. So I think I am going to leave it at that. I think I'm basically just saying the same thing over and over again here. Now, replicate arrays of independent samples from the same tissue, like, for example, where you would have a particular tumor and you might take two cuts of it and do independent RNA extractions and then array those things. Those are not technical replicates, and they're a kind of biological replicate. So that's why I say biological replicates is not always a completely well-defined thing. Those two cuts of the same tumor are biological replicates, but they're not really biological in the sense of representing different individuals. And they get at a different issue. They're really sort of, usually it's not something that's done, but in sort of a, if you have a diagnostic, some new diagnostic, some class predictor developed based on, or certainly if you have a class discovery sort of problem and you're claiming that you've seen these clusters, then having these kinds of replicates can be useful. You can see, it gives you a way of saying, if I use the alternative samples from the same tumors, you know, do I get the same kind of clusters? I think sample selection, I don't have anything too dramatic here. I've already talked about selecting a reference sample, and the experimental samples need to be representative of whatever kind of phenotype you're after. There's also something that often gets overlooked in that, a lot of times if you're using printed arrays, you may have a big experiment and you need multiple different print batches of slides, or you may be doing your hybridizations at different on different days and with different batches of reagents. And what you want to make sure of is that you don't have, if you're trying to compare, say, responders versus non-responders, you don't want to sort of do all your responders with this set of slides and then do all your non-responders with some other set of slides. Or do all your responders on this day and all of your non-responders on some other day. Because you may confound, you may wind up then saying, oh, I can really predict these things, but it may reflect something other than what you think you're predicting, the class distinction. And so so if it's too much to do with one set of reagents at one point in time, which very often it will be, you want to try to sort of balance it so that in each block of time you're doing some responders and some non-responders. I mean, these kinds of issues become of overriding importance. Well, they're very important in any study, but you know, studies where not, for example, I was thinking not microarray studies, but proteomic studies where people claim that they can diagnose like the ovarian cancer thing where you can diagnose ovarian cancer versus normal ovarian tissue versus non-cancer using proteomic analysis of blood. And a lot of times these studies, the tissue handling is totally different from the controls versus the cases. Sometimes the when they're assayed is different. These are all using sort of non-commercial kind of machines that are sort of probably drifting all over the place on different days. And so these kinds of just basic nitty-gritty, don't confound your class with your assay procedure, become of overriding importance. And they're the kinds of things that very often don't get, these details very often don't get reported in the papers. So reading other people's papers, you don't know whether, you know, they were, they're subject to those kind of issues or not. This is just to, so you have some citations of publications that we've made on experimental design. We're supposed to stop for a break?
Yeah.
Yeah. But why don't we just see if there's any questions here? And I think after this, we'll see if there are any questions, and then we'll have a break, and then we'll come back and I'll start talking a little bit about BRB array tools, and so we'll do it that way. Any questions, comments? Okay. How long should we?
It was 11:05, so how about this? Let's just have 15 minutes break and come back on 11:20, and then maybe. According to schedule, we have to end by 12 o'clock. So maybe
12 what?
12 o'clock.
12 o'clock.
Well, okay. We have 10 minutes late, so maybe we start at 12:10.
Okay. So we're going to start at, we're going to come back.
11:20.
11:20, okay.
Okay. No, let's use each other. See the answer down there.
To start with some crutches or just go
some what?
Some crutches from the floor.
Nobody had any questions.
Yeah, but I mean, later, because not. Actually, we should have break.